From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics. And here are the issues. The United States and Cuba agreed to restore diplomatic relations, and the U.S. will reopen its embassy in Havana, which has been closed since 1961. The historic agreement involved a swap of prisoners, including Alan Gross, a State Department aid worker jailed in Cuba for 5 years. Meanwhile, North Korea has been cited as the apparent hacker of Sony Pictures, an attack that caused Sony to cancel a movie, The Interview, about a plot to kill North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. U.S. investigators are gathering evidence and haven't decided how to respond to the cyber attack. And in American politics, Jeb Bush, the son of a president and the brother of another president, announced he's seriously considering running for president in 2016. Bush was governor of the state of Florida for 8 years. Well, Stephen, let me start with you. Let's talk about the deal, and then what are the broader implications of this? But what about the deal? It sort of struck me as one where the U.S. gave up a lot, and they got Alan Gross back and a spy who'd been in jail for nearly 20 years, but not much else.
Right. What's really interesting about this is the secret diplomacy that led up to this has been going on for almost 2 years. Nobody knew about it. It was a real bombshell this week when the president announced that not only was he getting Alan Gross back and doing this prisoner swap, but he was completely overhauling U.S. policy to Cuba, which has been in place for more than 50 years. There were secret talks going on between the U.S. and Cuba, in Canada, even in the Vatican. Pope Francis played a role. It's really a stunning development that sort of crept up on all of us. The question is now is, you know, where does this go forward? There are Republicans in Congress who are basically saying they're going to do everything they can to block this. People like Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who's the son of Cuban president, said he's going to stop President Obama appointing an ambassador to Cuba. So the president has taken one of his characteristic grand political gestures to change Cuba policy, and, you know, it's going to be a few months and a few years until we see how it plays out. But I don't think there's any going back, even for the next president. I don't see even a Republican president reversing this in a major way.
Yeah, I don't either. And the thing, Marco Rubio, I happen to agree with him. But on the other hand, there are a number of Republicans who have backed the president's action. And, well, what's your take about the deal, Barbara?
I think it's great for a number of reasons. I mean, it's great for Obama personally. The headlines are Obama Libre, you know, Obama is liberated. He had promised bold strokes toward rogue states when he came in, that he was going to reach out his hand and, you know, and unclench his fist if they would unclench theirs. I personally had been hoping that that might happen first with a country like Iran. Hasn't happened yet with Iran, but it has happened with Burma, now with Cuba. I think his policy all along is that engagement is the best policy when it comes to countries like this. You really have to try to crack them open through engagement. And, of course, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. We've been doing that with Cuba since 1961, and the Castros are still in power. I think it's going to be, it's obviously not a panacea for Cuba, but it is going to open the place up a bit, and certainly people are going to become economically more prosperous. That doesn't always lead to more political freedom, but it certainly makes for happier people. I mean, I think Cubans would love to have the experience that the Chinese have had, say, where they still have a one-party state, but they have tremendous economic opportunities that they didn't have before, and more freedom also in many ways. Cuba is just 90 miles off the coast of the United States. This whole thing was really an anomaly, and it was time for it to go.
Would this have been politically possible, do you think, Barbara, if Fidel Castro, rather than Raul Castro, his brother, were still in full power?
I don't know. I mean, I think it would have been harder for Fidel, maybe harder for the Cubans, because anti-Americanism has been such a plank for them and such a scapegoat for all these years. With the brother, Raul, in power, Fidel has literally faded from the scene since 2006. I doubt there are many young Americans who even know who he is. You know, I was thinking about this. Obama has, you know, he never knew a situation when we didn't have an embargo on Cuba. He grew up with this. And, you know, even for people like me, it's hard for me to remember. I don't really remember a pre-Castro Cuba, except on reruns of I Love Lucy. So for him, I think this is just a bit of unfinished business. It's like Guantanamo. You know, he wants to get it done.
Yeah, what happens to Guantanamo, as a matter of fact? That's one of the things that's unclear.
It stays, but I think Obama will empty that place one way or the other before he leaves. I also think this is a sign that he's going to do more bold things, and I'm looking for a deal with Iran, and soon.
Yes, Stephen, what about Guantanamo? What's going to happen in Cuba? I've been to Cuba. I went there 30 years ago with Jesse Jackson, and when he went, and then he was grandly hosted by Fidel Castro, who was certainly in full power back in 1984. It happened to be a year when Jesse Jackson was also running for president, but Castro is quite charismatic. He hasn't tested that in an election, but quite charismatic. Jackson swooned because he was treated so grandly by Castro. But you look around Havana, and you can see that it, even then, 30 years ago, it suffered a lot economically, and all the buildings were old and mildewy and so on, even the hotel we stayed in. But anyway, that's all I'm going to say about my trip there. Where does Cuba go now? What happens in Cuba? Barbara said the economy will improve, and then certainly there will be more investment, more money coming in.
Right. The big mystery is what happens when the Castro brothers finally fade from the scene, which can't be too long. I think an element of this from the U.S. point of view was kind of preparing for that day, getting into Cuba before the Castros fade, to perhaps have some small influence on how things play out. But one thing that's kind of interesting for me is that the administration's argument was that, okay, this hasn't worked, so we're going to fix it. So economic warfare hasn't worked. But in the same week, the administration has been arguing that economic warfare sanctions is working in a number of places, including against the Russians over their activities in Ukraine. And they argue that it's only sanctions that brought Iran to the table. That's an arguable point. But so there's a slight inconsistency in the administration's foreign policy there. But, you know, we don't know what's going to happen to Cuba. Sooner or later, this embargo probably would have been lifted when the Castros, when Raul Castro dies, when Fidel Castro dies. So I think in some ways this is just bringing forward what was inevitably going to happen.
Can I disagree with you, Stephen? Sanctions only work when they're multilateral. We have multilateral sanctions on Russia, multilateral sanctions on Iran. We had multilateral sanctions on South Africa.
Well, they worked in South Africa's case. I don't know that they've worked in Russia and Iran.
I think they are working. But in terms of Cuba, this was a unilateral embargo. So everybody else in the world was trading with them except for us. It was only penalizing United States, U.S. companies, Cuban Americans who wanted to be able to send more money back or invest in the place, and of course the Cuban people, since the United States, being so close, is the natural trading partner for a small country like that. It's going to take time to implement some of these things, but already we're seeing interest from U.S. hotel companies, from companies like Caterpillar that want to sell farm equipment. They want to sell building materials. So hopefully they won't tear down those beautiful old buildings. They'll just renovate them.
No, I agree.
You know, before they crumble. I'd like to see some of those 1950s cars still in the streets, but I'm sure the Cubans would prefer to have newer models.
The Cubans are very resourceful to keep those cars from the 50s still running.
And there are aspects of the Cuban system, let's not forget, really pretty good health care. They export doctors. They've played a big role in the Ebola crisis. Educational system isn't that bad, so especially if they get the internet, I think this country's really poised to take off.
They do export doctors and then have to send guards along so the doctors won't defect.
Don't defect, yes, that's true.
What about human rights? I mean, that seems to be a legitimate complaint. I'm going to read an editorial from the Washington Post.
Yeah,
Not from the Weekly Standard now.
I know, I read
from
it.
From the Washington Post. It says this, Mr. Obama says normalizing relations will allow the United States to be more effective in promoting political change in Cuba. This is contrary to U.S. experience with communist regimes such as Vietnam, where normalization has led to no improvements on human rights in two decades. Moreover, nothing in Mr. Obama's record of lukewarm and inconstant support for democratic change across the globe can give Ms. Sanchez, who's a dissident in Cuba, can give Ms. Sanchez and her fellow freedom fighters confidence in this promise.
Yeah, well, look, 54 years we've had the embargo, human rights have not improved. I mean, it is time to change the situation.
Well, then why didn't Obama get some?
Supposedly, they're going to release 53 Cuban prisoners as
well. I
know, but
4 years ago, Raul Castro said he was releasing all the political prisoners.
I don't think that the embargo was producing a desired result. Whether easing the embargo will produce that result remains to be seen, but I think it does put the U.S. on a better footing to talk about human rights with Cuba, because many of these countries that have been sanctioned accuse the United States. They say when the United States imposes sanctions, that is a violation of human rights, because the people who suffer most are the ordinary people in these countries. So now we can take that card away from the Castro regime, and I think that's important. In terms of changing the regime itself, that is a job for the Cuban people. And the more contact they have with the outside world, I think, frankly, the easier it may be for them. And certainly it will improve their living standards. And it's very hard to concentrate on regime change when you have an empty stomach.
What about the impact, I'll start with you, Stephen, on this, around Latin America, this move by the United States?
I was talking to an official this week, and they said that the president has come under increasing pressure from leaders of Latin America to shift U.S. policy on Cuba. Various regional summits he's been to, leaders come to him and say, you know, this is actually now becoming a great impediment to your policy goals in Latin America. So from that standpoint, I think the president will get some credit within the region for what he's done. There's another interesting angle to this, in fact, that if you look at the Cuban motivation for moving on this, officials also think that it may have something to do with the price of oil. Cuba is sort of a client, if you like, of Venezuela, a big oil exporting country, which has its own political problems and has been severely impacted by the massive drop in the price of oil, like some other nations like Iran and Russia we've talked about are also experiencing that. And Cuba may have calculated that its own economic interests, in fact, lie with a more open relationship mm-hmm. with the United States. Cuba also has a historical relationship with Russia. Its economy is plunging into free fall, the ruble's crashing. So it may, in fact, have been an economic calculation by the Cubans as much as a political calculation to sort of enter into this new opening with the United States.
Barbara, you were sort of suggesting this but didn't elaborate on it, so please elaborate on this question of how will this affect American interests around Latin America?
I think Stephen is right. This has been a distraction and an impediment to better U.S. relations in Latin America. The only country that had this odd situation with Cuba. Now Cuba can start attending regional summits, and it will no longer be an issue between the United States and Venezuela. I think we can see some benefits perhaps for Colombia, where a long-running guerrilla war may finally come to an end. The Cubans have been trying to mediate an end to that war. So it's important on a number of fronts. You know, it's a piece of history that just had to be dealt with sooner or later.
How will it affect, say, Venezuela? Venezuela is a country that's very close to Cuba and is sort of not quite as anti-American, but but getting there.
It's been very anti-American, yeah. And actually I think President Maduro said some positive things about this. It could help ease the divisions between the United States and Venezuela. And the U.S. will be, you know, now fully part of the region in which it lives. It's very important.
What about Venezuela? Venezuela is a country that has been hurt, of course, by, as I think you were suggesting, by the plunge in oil prices. And it can't help Cuba the way it has. But how will this change in policy affect Venezuela?
It may leave Venezuela more isolated within the region. It may have to come to its own calculations about its posture towards the United States. Hitherto, the Obama administration has not really had much of a legacy in Latin America. Had gone through difficult spells with Argentina, for example, Brazil, the big powers in that region. So I think there are 2 years left in this administration. I think you might see the president concentrate more on Latin America, and Venezuela is clearly going to be part of that calculation. And so the government in Venezuela may look at this and decide it might be time to sort of moderate some of their hostility towards the United States. And like we said, the global price of oil is causing some geopolitical ructions all over the world, and Venezuela
certainly
might be part of that.
A final question sort of about Cuba's economy. You know, Cuba has been trading with European countries, Canada, heavily with Canada, for instance, and all other Latin American countries. Why is getting rid of the embargo, the trade embargo, which actually needs to be removed by Congress, and probably will, and I suspect the ambassador to Cuba will probably be approved by the Senate over the objections of a number of Republicans, particularly Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, and a Cuban-American himself. Why has the Cuban economy done so poorly with all this help from other countries?
Well, the system there is poor. I mean, it's a socialist system that has not given much initiative to private individuals. They've started to open it in pockets here and there, you know, restaurants run out of your home kind of thing. Reminds me of what China was doing back in the early 1980s when they were just beginning to lift some of these restrictions. They have to do a lot more to really empower ordinary individuals. And I think with the prospect of a lot more investment from Cuban Americans and big American companies just 90 miles away, I think that's a powerful incentive for that kind of change.
Well, I think it probably is. Let me ask one final question. I know, Stephen, you were surprised by this. I was. I mean, coming at this time, were you surprised, Barbara?
Yes and no. I mean, I think we've seen Obama already, you know, act on things like immigration and so on. I think Obama is really getting into his stride, and he's going to use the powers of his office for both domestic and foreign policy issues, and he's going to move as far as he can, as fast as he can, while he's in office.
Well, maybe he'll do things with countries friendly to the United States rather than just ones that are opposed to the United States. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues in the News as a podcast. The program is also available for a free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues-in-the-news. Well, this hacking of Sony Pictures, the blame has really been landed on the North Koreans, Stephen, though the evidence seems to be pretty skimpy, but there is a motive there. Certainly this movie, why Sony Pictures was making a movie about North Korea and a couple of jokers going in there with the job of assassinating the leader of North Korea. But in any case, what happens now? I mean, what does the United States do? Is North Korea going to get away with this? Sony Pictures capitulated to this country that still lives in the Stone Age.
Right. I think this is an absolutely fascinating story. Mm. If it wasn't so serious, it'd be kind of amusing. You know, there are two issues here. First of all, Sony Pictures has decided not to show this movie in cinemas in the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, in the United States, there's supposed to be freedom of speech. You're supposed to be able to say anything you like, even if it is offensive to people. So that is the first issue. I understand that some officials in the administration are actually not that happy that Sony capitulated so quickly on this, basically because it opens the possibility that anybody could do exactly the same thing if they don't agree with something, you know, a country, if you don't agree with criticisms being made in the United States of a leader, a totalitarian leader, they could hack something as well. So it's first of all, there's that issue. The second issue is, how do you respond to this? The White House says it's looking for a proportional response. If you're sort of in a black and white way, that would presumably involve the United States hacking something in North Korea. But if you go down that road, you get into a very dangerous cycle of escalation, and it's not worth getting into a cycle that could lead to war on the Korean Peninsula over a stupid movie. So I think there are several things the White House is thinking about. One of them is this idea of imposing sanctions on Chinese banks through which North Korea does most of its dealings with the outside world, which could be a very painful thing, but then you risk sort of angering China over
indeed.
This. So it's actually quite a puzzle for the administration about how exactly to respond to this.
Well, they can't, Barbara, apply economic sanctions because there's not much of an economy to sanction in North Korea. What do you do?
There are already a number of economic sanctions on North Korea. I think Sony should just release the thing for free on the internet so the whole world can watch it. That would be the best revenge, frankly, against the North Koreans. Thinking about this incident, though, and what Hollywood does, and they're sort of running out of bad guys. Mm-hmm. It's no longer politically correct to have movies where you have the heavy be an Arab. There are big complaints about that. Mm. And so you're searching for a bad guy. Who's left? Well, the North Koreans are a pretty good candidate,
well,
I must say. And there was a hilarious film a few years back called Team America, which featured puppets going into North Korea. There was a puppet of Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, who famously sang, "I'm so wrongly." It was very funny. You need to watch it, although they apparently pulled that also from the movies right now. So North Korea, it's a big ripe target for Hollywood. I think releasing the movie for free, don't try to get people to pay because, of course, Sony has been hacked, so nobody would want to give their credit card information to Sony. The other thing, though, is I think everyone should be once again warned about how insecure the internet is and that nothing that you put on the internet will necessarily remain private. People should be aware of that. Certainly the Sony executives who sent racist emails to each other should be aware of that. In terms of actually retaliating in some way against North Korea. There isn't much of an infrastructure there to hack. So it certainly couldn't be tit for tat. But I would assume that our cybersecurity people are learning from this and learning about vulnerabilities, which they will share with Sony and with other American companies.
Well, that will be a positive. The other thing is the movie theater change really sort of got off the hook here. There was a somewhat, well, I wouldn't say vague, but mysterious threat that the theaters that showed this movie would be bombed, and they all almost immediately said, well, we won't show it.
Right.
Now, that was not a profiling courage on the part of the movie chains.
No, exactly. And that goes back to that question of, you know, it doesn't take much to cow the entertainment industry, clearly.
I'll say.
Having said that, had the movie gone ahead and some crazy person done something, everyone would have been second-guessing him and saying, well, why did you show this movie? But, you know, I think there's some pretty serious questions about, you know, not responding to this in the correct way, and that's going to set a very difficult precedent, put it that way.
Jeb Bush, the second son of George H.W. Bush, who was the first Bush president, and the brother of George W. Bush, who was the second Bush president, he preceded President Obama in office at the White House, and now Jeb says he's seriously considering running, which means pretty much that he's going to run for the Republican nomination in 2016. There are differences among the Bushes, but they really, I don't think they're readily apparent to most people. But my question is, I'll start with you, Barbara. I mean, there seems to be some royalist streak in America. I mean, certainly a not insignificant chance that we could wind up with another Clinton-Bush presidential race, Hillary Clinton versus Jeb Bush in 2016.
Yeah, well, we do have political families. I mean, there were the Kennedys. How many of them have run for office and continue to run for office on the strength of the family name and also a history of public service? So the Bushes are not alone in this. And we should also remember that back more than a decade ago, people were talking about Jeb as the more likely presidential candidate, frankly, than George W. Jeb is supposed to be more, dare I say, intellectual than George W. And he has certainly a more interesting resume in a lot of ways. He married a Mexican-American woman, and so he has an affinity with the Latino community, which could be extremely useful.
Speaks Spanish fluently.
Speaks Spanish fluently, has a very telegenic son, George P., who I think already has won some sort of office in Texas.
He was elected land commissioner, which is sort of
a doubt,
but it's a stepping stone.
It's a stepping stone. So he was always considered, frankly, the more plausible candidate to follow his father into the White House. The other reason is that when you look at the Republican field, there aren't other names that immediately come forward. There was Chris Christie, but then there was a scandal over the George Washington Bridge, and others have various baggage attached to them. I don't think anybody really wants to see Mitt Romney as a candidate again. He had his chance, and it didn't work.
No, there is a group.
It didn't
work. They're all his aides. All his advisors would like to have him run.
The chances are pretty slim. You have some people on the far right. You have some interesting candidates like Rand Paul, who has a certain following but probably would not make it, I think, through the primary process. So it's interesting. And yes, it could be Clinton versus Bush again. That would be quite interesting.
Yeah, Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky and a libertarian, by the way, was one of those who endorsed the Obama policy, the Obama opening to Cuba.
I'm sure he did.
Stephen?
This is why American politics is so much fun to cover. You know, I mean, who would have thought 6 years ago that the day of President Obama's inauguration, George W. Bush flew in his helicopter over the National Mall, everyone was waving goodbye, mocking this guy whose approval ratings were in the tank. 6 years later, we're looking at possibly the potential of his brother becoming president. I mean, things change so fast here. I think there are a number of issues. I think that Jeb Bush has a complicated route towards the nomination, put it that way. He's staked out some positions which on education and immigration, which would tend to sort of alienate him from the conservative base of the Republican Party. On the other hand, he's going to have no problem raising money, which is a key point. Often, you know, the establishment candidate does win out in Republican primaries, even though they end up getting a strong challenge from sort of a candidate that is supported by the grassroots. So I think it's going to be very interesting. One thing you could say about Jeb Bush is this is a very bold step he's taken. Nobody expected him to come out so quickly and say, pretty much as you said, that he's running. So he's really seized the initiative in the Republican race, and it's going to be up to others to respond. Just one thing on the Hillary Clinton angle. In some ways, I think it would be good to have a Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush race, because it would take away some of the more frivolous issues that we would like to see if one of those candidates is. So if Hillary was running against a younger Republican, we'd have an argument about the generation. Mm-hmm. Is she too old? Mm-hmm. There'd be questions about the finances of these candidates, mm-hmm. like we saw with Mitt Romney. You know, Hillary's been raising millions of dollars with speeches, and Jeb Bush has his own background in investment banking. So paradoxically, it might be sort of going back a generation and two older candidates mm-hmm. that perhaps don't have as much of a vision for the future, but maybe we could these two serious American governing mm-hmm. families actually have a decent argument in the election if they were both candidates.
Yeah, both are in their 60s.
Yeah.
Many of the people who've been touted, Marco Rubio's one, who are in their 40s. What about this, Barbara? America, Obama's an exception, but America often elects governors. Mm-hmm. President, because they've had executive power, they've known how to organize a government, and on and on, which is an advantage, but maybe not that big a one.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it didn't work for Mitt Romney, did it?
No.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think it depends very much on the candidate, and certainly with Hillary Clinton, although she was not president, mm-hmm. she was first lady, so she's yeah. mm-hmm. intimately familiar with what it takes to run a White House.
Here's one other thing. You know who has become a great friend of the Bush family?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
Bill Clinton. I
now,
know.
Bill's
yeah.
friends with almost everyone, but particularly yeah. with the Bushes.
Yeah, I think that actually could set up a very civil kind of campaign. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might disappoint the political reporters who are looking for, you know, for the nastiness there, but mm-hmm. there actually is a fairly good relationship between these two families. Mm-hmm. So it would be really a question of, you know, shades of gray in terms of their visions about the economy and foreign policy. There wouldn't be maybe those stark distinctions that we sometimes see.
Now, I took that as an attack on you, Stephen. Are you going to be disappointed if it's a civil a presidential campaign?
I've got a lot of faith in the American political system to throw up a rancorous, uncivil argument in the election. And I think whoever's the candidate, there's too much at stake for it to be dull, boring, and civil.
Well, the vice presidential candidates hopefully will take care of the nastiness.
Yeah, if necessary, they will, for sure. Anyway, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.